Lens 68. The lens of the hero's journey. Many heroic stories have similar structure and use this lens to make sure that you haven't missed out on any elements that might improve your story. Ask yourself these questions. Does my story have elements that qualify it as a heroic story? If so, how does it match up with the structure of the hero's journey? Would my story be improved by including more archetypical elements? Does my story match this form so closely that it feels hackneyed?
It seems difficult to match a form itself so closely that it feels hackneyed. I mean, some of the greatest stories are the definitive hero's journey stories. That's why they're some of the greatest stories, and that's why the hero's journey is the thing that we talk about.
Yeah. I think maybe he means matching one of the examples so closely or something.
Yeah, well, that would be a problem, because then you're basically plagiarizing.
You just take hero's journey elements from a bunch of stories and push them together.
Yeah. Don't even bother renaming the characters.
There we go.
Just have Cloud Strife run into Wedge Antilles and things like that. Wait, that happened.
Was that in, where was that?
That's Final Fantasy VII, and it's not as blatant as I made it sound, but in the opening scenes of Final Fantasy VII, where Cloud is participating as a member of that eco-terrorist group, two of the people are named Wedge and, I think, Dak, who are wingmates of Luke Skywalker from A New Hope.
Wow.
Dak dies, and Wedge goes on to also participate in episodes 5 and 6, and I think something similar might happen in Final Fantasy VII, but it's also possible that we never see those guys again. I can't remember.
So was that the translators doing?
Yeah, I don't know. Like, is this a joke that they can make in Japan, or I have no idea where it came from, but it's sure in the game.
Well, that segues nicely into Lens 69, the lens of the weirdest thing.
All right.
Having weird things in your story can help give meaning to unusual game mechanics. It can capture the interest of the player, and it can make your world seem special. Too many things that are too weird, though, will render your story puzzling and inaccessible. To make sure your story is the good kind of weird, ask yourself these questions. What is the weirdest thing in my story? How can I make sure that the weirdest thing doesn't confuse or alienate the player? If there are multiple weird things, should I, maybe, get rid of or coalesce some of them? If there's nothing weird in my story, is the story actually still interesting?
So, the first thing that came to mind when I started hearing this lens was actually the recent movie, Jumanji. Not the one from when I was a kid, but the recent one with Dwayne The Rock Johnson and all that. Where the movie kind of embraces the idea that it is about a game, and in this case specifically a video game. And it does so in a way that even most video game movies do not, by admitting the mechanics. Where most video games say, well, you know, if we believe this guy, every game is built on mechanics, story, and aesthetics, and technology. But video games all share the same technology for the most part. Anyway, and most video game movies take the mechanics out entirely, and in some cases, they take the story out entirely, and they're like, we're just going to make a movie that's more or less in the same world as the video games that you played, so you'll see recognizable things, but we're not going to tell a story that you're familiar with, and we're not going to communicate the game mechanics. And so, two of the things that you probably like best about the game are just gone, and it makes the game harder to enjoy for people who, or it makes the movie harder to enjoy for people who like the game, and it removes some of the valuable content that was produced for the game. And Jumanji, while it is about a game that does not exist or did not exist before the movie came out, maybe it does now, they include the game mechanics in the movie, and it really does kind of wind up being the weirdest thing, where the characters in the movie can talk about kind of when they're activating their abilities, and it gives them cartoonishly exaggerated powers. Like one of them just says sprint and then starts running as fast as a car. All the different characters have strengths and weaknesses, and the one that can run as fast as a car, one of his strengths is running. And then some of the characters have weaknesses, and well, you might expect weaknesses to be something that is just inconvenient. They actually make you explode. So,
oh
yeah, one of the guys has a weakness to cake.
So he just explodes in the presence of cake?
He ate a piece of cake thinking that it was bread, and then he exploded.
So I assume this is like the end, or do they respawn?
They respawn. Lives? Yeah, they do. And they use their respawn mechanic in the final boss fight, because they respawn by falling out of the air, and they needed to be able to hand something off, but only one of the characters could get up high enough to actually hand it to get it anywhere, and so they used another character. They had another character use one of her weaknesses, which was snakes. She got bitten by a snake, she exploded, and then she respawned, fell out of the air, and was able to get the thing and put it where it needed to go.
Wow.
And so the whole thing came full circle. It was actually a very impressive video game movie for a movie that is not about an extant video game.
Well, that's probably convenient for them because they could contrive the video game mechanics to be convenient for the movie.
Yes, it probably did make it easier. But none of the video game mechanics they used are particularly outlandish as a video game mechanic. A little sure. Dated, maybe.
Yeah.
But none of them are unrecognizable.
Oh, cool. So, your mechanics, then, can be the weirdest thing in your story, in your game story.
Yep, I think so.
Yeah, makes sense. And finally, we have Lens 70, the lens of story. Ask yourself these questions. A prop's nothing.
I think that word is apropos.
Apropos nothing?
Yes. It does have the S in everything, but it's pronounced apropos.
Well, okay. Does my game really need a story, and why? Why will players be interested in this story? How does the story support other parts of the Tetrad? Aesthetics, technology, and gameplay, and can it do its job better? How do the other parts of the Tetrad support the story, and can they do a better job? And how can my story be better?
Those seem like good questions that every game-making storyteller should ask themselves. I support this lens.
Indeed. Now we're in Chapter 16. Story and game structures can be artfully merged with indirect control. So we're in the chapter of indirect control. And the first lens is Lens 71, the lens of freedom. A feeling of freedom is one of the things that separates games from other forms of entertainment. To make sure your players feel as free as possible, ask yourself these questions. When do my players have freedom of action? Do they feel free at these times? When are they constrained? Do they feel constrained at these times? Are there any places I can let them feel more free than they do now? Are there any places where they are overwhelmed by too much freedom?
Extra Credits had an episode about this yesterday, sort of.
Oh, really?
It was pretty specifically about that last question. It was about the paralysis of choice.
Oh, yeah.
Where you have so many options that you can't decide what to do, so you just put the game down and go do something else. And they talk about analysis paralysis, where it comes from the...
under constraint of a design.
Yeah, well, the choice riding on your ability to analyze a complicated system. And so then you're left feeling like, well, you're always unsure that you have sufficiently explored the mechanics that you're trying to exploit. And so you can't be confident that any decision you might make is the best one. And then they distinguish that from choice paralysis, which is just, here are a bunch of more or less meaningless choices. What color does your character's hair want to be? And you're like, I don't want to make all these choices right now. And you just leave.
Right. So, like, having a randomized button that just makes a bunch of choices for you if you're not interested in doing it right now.
Yeah, they had a few options that some of them were, like, just break the choices up over a few different screens. Instead of having your character creation screen have all the aesthetic choices and all the statistical choices and all the class choices and things like that on the same screen, break it up a little bit.
Yeah.
Just, like, so appear less threatening.
So it's not often that the advice is be more like Dwarf Fortress, but in this case, it is.
Hey, there you go. I don't think I've ever played a Dwarf Fortress mode where you have to create a character, but...
Oh, it's adventure mode.
Nice.
And there is a lot that could be improved on, even in that, but it does break it up over several screens.
Yeah, there you go. It's a non-threatening approach to character creation. Except that everything is in ASCII art, so it's already threatening.
Still threatening. And none of the skills or abilities have any explanation given.
Yeah, well, and that was something they didn't cover very much that I thought they should have. Because they were like, one of the things they said was, when you just give me a character page and you're like, you know, assign points to strength, dexterity, and intelligence, if the player doesn't have any real context to know, well, what are these things going to do, then the character can't make an informed decision and may feel paralyzed by the choice you've given him. And those are things that people who have played games before, particularly role-playing games and particularly pen and paper role-playing games, can look at that and say, oh, they're asking me if I want to be a fighter, a rogue, or a mage, and I could probably even be some kind of hybrid of the two if I up two of these stats and dump the other. And whereas someone who doesn't have that context, someone who hasn't played a fantasy game and isn't familiar with those statistics as named,
yeah,
doesn't know why those might be important, it's just like, well, I guess I'll just bring them all up as high as they can go, which is, of course, the worst decision you could make.
Yeah.
But I feel like those things could be really helped by just explaining your game a little bit, telling your players what they're doing, or putting class choice first, like, because a class generally is a recognizable set of abilities, right? And so you're like, oh, this is a ranger. He's kind of like Aragorn. He fights with a sword and sometimes with a bow and explores the wilderness. And the stats that are important to him are strength and sometimes dexterity, but never intelligence. He's dumb as a sack of hammers.
It would also be nice, as an aside, if the mental stats had their own point pool. So that, because, like, Aragorn is strong, but he's also wise, right? He's not intelligent, but he's wise.
Right.
He's not charismatic either, right? So, like, it would make sense for you to have a separate pool so you could be like, all right, well, what kind of mental stats does my character need? And then what kind of physical stats does my character need? Anyway. Right. It will also make a lot of sense if you don't have clear classes to have examples.
Right.
I remember a game called Runer, which is someone who uses runes, apparently, because the whole thing's about runes. And you can combine different runes to make different spells that do different things. But it's really difficult to tell what those different spells will do when you combine them. But in the game, on the rune combination page, there's a little screen in the bottom right corner, a little window, where your character stands. And when you're combining runes, it shows an example of the spell being used and how much damage it does on an example enemy. Or, like, how much healing it does to yourself, or whatever, like, whatever effect it has. So there's these two little characters just moving toward each other, and then it does the spell, and then you can see the result of the spell on the little window. And it was just brilliant. I don't know why games don't do that more often, especially computer games can. Obviously, paper games is a lot more difficult, but right. It was just a fantastic little system that let you know what you were doing and how it was going to affect the game.
Yeah. That sort of thing is a really good idea. And another thing that came to mind when you were explaining that concept was GURPS, right? Where GURPS is this giant set of rules and you can use those rules to make just about any kind of character.
Yeah.
And participate in just about any kind of interaction.
Right.
But because the space is so large, it's pretty difficult unless you already have a strong idea of specifically everything that you want to be able to do to make a character that would be recognizable as a ranger, to continue the Aragorn example.
Sure.
And I feel, and so in the past when I've used that system in some games, I have deliberately given people prepackaged characters just to reduce the amount of choice.
Yeah.
And specific players, right? Like some players want to spend 4 hours going over the rules and finding every little thing they might want to exploit later.
Right.
But some players don't. And in pen and paper games, as the game master, you have the freedom to say, well, this player wants some hand-holding and this player doesn't, and give the player who wants hand-holding a prepackaged character and just be like, here you go, it's basically a rogue, have fun.
Sure. Although GURPS does do a fairly decent job of explaining what the different numbers mean, although it really has no other option.
Right. GURPS does an exhaustive job of explaining what most of the numbers mean.
Yeah.
But that doesn't help some people, right?
Yeah. Like, and it certainly doesn't help the overall situation of analysis paralysis.
Right.
Where there's no overall index of, here's the kinds of characters you might want to make. They don't provide many examples of fully fleshed out characters. I think there are some.
I recall not liking any of their examples.
Their templates are not good.
Yeah, well, yeah. I'm not saying they're not good, just none of them resembled a character I wanted to make, so
okay.
I got to the example section at the back of the book, and I was like, well, here's a bunch of, wait, no, what? No, I don't want to play any of these characters. This one is a politician. That sounds so boring.
Well, that's kind of the question of GURPS, is if you don't want to do anything but play rangers and rogues, then you should play Rangers and Rogues, the game, which is also called Dungeons and Dragons.
Right. Yeah. I agree that there's depth to the GURPS system that is lacking in the more combat-centric systems, but when you're playing a high fantasy game of some kind, even if you don't want it to be all about combat all the time, you probably want your characters to be fantastically powerful along some axis.
Yeah.
And if you want to tell an exciting story, that axis is probably not politics. But, like I said, none of their examples really spoke to me. They were probably effective in communicating ways to combine the skills. But none of them were, hey, I want to make a rogue, how do I do that?
And that also kind of brings to mind the complaint that Seamus was making the other day on his blog about people not giving advice because they presume that there's no good reason to do what you're trying to do.
I feel like he's missing an element of these interactions, and I feel like most of the commenters did too. So the specific context here is famous web blogger Seamus Young is trying to learn a new programming language, and he's trying to relate his previous programming experience to his current programming goals and limitations. And he's trying to find out how to do a thing, and he asks on the internet, and the people on the internet don't give helpful answers, and they say things like, you don't need to know that, or why would you need to know that, or if you think you need to know that, you probably don't know what you're doing. And while some of them are, generally speaking, he accuses these people of knowing the answer and refusing to give it, and sometimes he might be right, but I feel like he's overlooking a possibility where a lot of these people don't know the answer, but have nothing better to do with their time than sit on programming forums. Maybe they do, but they aren't using it. And they're there, and they're just answering out of a sense of obligation to answer. They're like, well, I'm here, I want to answer his question, I don't actually know the answer, I'm just going to sound smug and superior instead. And, I mean, that makes them lousy trolls, but it doesn't make them intentionally obstructive trolls.
Right. And it could also possibly be from a sense of obligation to try to help someone where they're like, well, I don't know the answer, but I'm going to do what I can by helping you to clarify what your question is.
Right. I just feel like if that's the case, you should admit up front, I don't know how to do that either.
Here's right.
my justification for continuing in that ignorance.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And there are a number of places... There are a number of places where he's trying to do something that the language is not really well designed for, but that doesn't excuse people from not being helpful and wasting time answering questions in an unhelpful way.
Correct.
Lens 72, the lens of indirect control. Every player has a vision of what they would like the players to do to have an ideal play experience. Wow, that was... Sentence needs revision. To help ensure that players do these things of their own free will, ask yourself these questions. Ideally, what would I like the players to do? Can I set constraints to get the players to do it? Can I set goals to get the players to do it? Can I design my interface to get the players to do it? Can I use visual design to get the players to do it? Can I use in-game characters to get the players to do it? Can I use music or sound to get the players to do it? Is there some other method I can use to coerce players toward ideal behavior without impinging on their feeling of freedom?
I feel like if none of the answers to those questions are yes, you have made a grave error. Because he's basically just listing almost every way that you could possibly communicate your goals to the player.
Right. Well, and I would object in general to having narrow goals for the player in the first place that you have to coerce them into, I suppose.
Well, I think some of it is about prompting the player to be in the correct mindset, too, for what your game is doing right now.
Sure.
I played half an hour of Tomb Raider last night, and one of the things that I was reminded of while I was playing it is the music cues are pretty strong as to what state your character is in. So you can tell that your combat encounter hasn't ended yet because the combat music is still playing. And then you have to figure out why haven't more faceless mooks come out to be mowed down by my fire arrows. And it's because you haven't walked over here yet. But it prompts you to kind of explore the battlefield a little bit and say, well, I know there are more faceless mooks because the combat music is still playing. And so it's not necessarily about how do I get the player to walk from point A to point B. I think it's also about how do I communicate to the player the state that they need to be in right now in order to respond to the way the game is behaving. Because at the time, all of the faceless mooks were concealed behind trash cans or whatever, and I needed to move around to expose them to trigger the next wave of combat. And so it wasn't necessarily, it wasn't as narrow a goal as walk to point B, but it was a useful piece of communication that the game had that informed my next choice.
Yeah. Alright, cool. It's, but that's not so much control as information, right? Like,
yeah,
the game isn't telling you, hey, we really want you to be a better Tomb Raider, or here's my idea of what a Tomb Raider should do in this situation. Why don't you go do that instead of whatever you're doing right now?
Well, so I don't think anything in this indirect control lens could really be viewed as making the player do a thing. You're just informing the most straightforward decision for the player, and by doing that, you're essentially guiding them along a path.
Yeah.
They don't have to follow the path. In Tomb Raider, there are basically two directions, forwards and backwards. And backwards, you can branch out and go to any place you've been before. And that's because the game has a completionist aspect to it, where you can go back and you can find every little widget laying on the ground or whatever and pick it up. And the more widgets you find, the more skill points you get, the more upgrades you get for your weapons, whatever. So if you feel stuck at a certain point, you can go back in the game and try to upgrade one of your weapons or try to get some more skill points by doing the completionist things. Or if you just want to go back and finish all the things that you skipped because you were just trying to get through the story, you can do that too.
Are there Metroidvania aspects where you get tools later on in the game that can be used to unlock areas earlier in the game that were unlockable before?
It's possible. It's possible. I only remember one thing that I couldn't open because I didn't have the upgraded pry bar yet. And I don't remember if we went back to that as a part of getting the upgraded pry bar. Or if I could still go back to it now. I mean, certainly I could go back to that area now, but I don't remember if it's still there waiting to be opened.
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's possible.
If it does have that aspect, it seems like it would be important for them to label those locations in some way.
Yeah, the Lego Star Wars game does that, where there are areas that only certain classes can get to. It just tells you on the screen, only stormtroopers can get here. And you haven't unlocked any stormtroopers yet, so there's no way for you to get there.
Is there, like, an overworld map of some kind that you can see all the areas that are locked because of certain characters, or...?
Not in LEGO Star Wars, no.
Okay, because that's kind of what I was thinking of, is it'd be nice to have a convenient way to keep track of that stuff, since the game's already keeping track of it.
Yeah, it would be. LEGO Star Wars is not big on convenience. It's a fairly fun, we'll call it medium fun, platformer, where the primary joy of LEGO Star Wars, the game, is playing it with kids who just want to see Star Wars things doing silly things on the television screen.
Okay.
Because there are a lot of kind of physical comedy aspects to it, where you can use the Force on stuff to do silly things, and death is not actually an important thing in the game unless... I think it ever. So you can, like, there is friendly fire. You can just, like, beat each other up. So it feels pretty sandboxy and lets you kind of do whatever you want, even though when you actually get into a level, it's strongly linear.
So does LEGO Star Wars help you know how to be a better LEGO person? Or, do you feel like they could have used more indirect control?
There is no advancement in that game that I have found. So that's not really a thing. It gives you some guidance for where you could go to get more treasure, which since there's no advancement, it just gives you points.
Can't you use points to unlock other characters or something?
You can use points to unlock some aesthetic things.
Oh, okay.
Baby characters? I think, for the most part, characters are unlocked by advancing the story.
And it's linear, so it's not like you can get lost.
Yeah. And I don't know when they give you stormtroopers, but it's not in episodes 1, 2, or 3, and that's all I've actually played.
I remember having some trouble, I don't know if it was LEGO Star Wars, but in some LEGO game, knowing what to do. We got to a certain point, and we're fighting some foe of some kind, and it's like, I don't know what to do here. There's clearly some objects in the world that I can interact with, but I don't know how I'm supposed to interact with them to do a thing.
Yeah. I had a similar moment, I think it was in episode 1 in LEGO Star Wars, where you're in a part of the game where the challenge is clearly a platforming puzzle. You have to put platforms together in such a way that one of your non-force characters can get up into an air vent or something like that. And so your force characters can double jump and they could all get there any time. But you need to be able to get Amidala or somebody in there and she can't double jump. And there was some hokey thing that you had to push, but it didn't give you basically the problem was that the object you were supposed to interact with was indistinguishable from the background.
Oh no.
And I eventually just gave up and had to look up a walkthrough because I'm like, I've been here for half an hour with my bored son wondering when we're going to move on to the next part of the level.
Right.
And I've just been running around leaning on things and pushing the force button all over the place, even though nothing lights up with the force aura.
Yeah.
And there was some, like, plant pot that you had to break, and when you broke it, it unveiled a button, and when you stepped on the button, it released a chair, and then you could use the force on the chair or something. But wow. The plant pot just looked like scenery, and I hadn't got to the point where I just hulked out and started trying to break everything.
Ah.
Maybe they were waiting for that. I don't know.
They were hoping that you would much earlier.
Yeah.
Had they been training you throughout the game to just break everything?
Yes.
Aha!
Breaking things generally gives you points. You pretty much always get points, and sometimes you get health out of.
But you were in your own palace or whatever, and it seemed inappropriate.
Yeah. Well, and there was nothing that obviously needed breaking.
It's a Lego game. Can't you break everything?
You cannot break everything.
What?
You can't break the scenery, right? There are scenery and there are objects, and you can break most objects. Not all objects, because any object that is necessary as a part of the platforming game, you can't break. But objects that are basically scenery, like plant pots, you generally can break. But objects that are just scenery, like columns, you can't break. And this one looked more like a piece of structure to me than a decoration. Yeah. So I had not thought to break it.
Needs more indirect control.
Yeah.
Lens 73, the lens of collusion. Characters should fulfill their roles in the game world, but when possible, also serve as the many minions of the game designer, working toward the designer's ultimate aim, which is to ensure an engaging experience for the player. His ultimate aim keeps changing.
It sure does.
To make sure that your characters are living up to this responsibility, ask yourself these questions. What do I want the player to experience? How can the characters help fulfill this experience without compromising their goals in the game world?
Okay. I feel like this is basically just, what is game? The question.
He's back. He's back for more. What even is game? And how do we game? His quote below is a pretty good one. The Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu wrote, "When the best leader's work is done, the people say, we did it ourselves."
Sure. And I feel like this basically just goes back to the lens of indirect control, where indirect control is about prompting action on the part of the player, so they will feel like they have made the decision to take this action on their own, but you have guided them towards it, and so you can see, as an observer, how your actions informed their decisions, but they maybe can't, depending on just how aware of their surroundings they are.
Yeah. Well, now we're in Chapter 17. Stories and games take place in worlds. And as you may or may not recall, there's only one lens in the lens of world. Lens 74, the lens of the world. The world of your game is a thing that exists apart. Your game is a doorway to the magic place that exists only in the imagination of your players. To ensure your world has power and integrity, ask yourself these questions. How is my world better than the real world? Can there be multiple gateways to my world, and how do they differ? How do they each support each other? Is my world centered on a single story, or could many stories happen here? And I feel like the lens of the world is the lens through which I most favoritely view games. That didn't come out very well. Anyway, this is my favorite lens, because I feel like the access to the game world is the thing that games provide that is unique to games. By
right.
Allowing people to get into the game world, whereas in other media you can only learn about the game.
You can only see other people getting into Narnia.
Right. Oh man, is there an Adventures in Narnia game?
If there is, it's probably terrible.
Oh, now I've got to. Sheesh. Now I got to do that. It sounds amazing.
Yeah, you could run a Adventures in Narnia GURPS campaign.
Oh man. I don't know if GURPS is the right system. You might have to make your own RP system. Oh man, that would be really cool. The ultimate game is game design.
Yep. But yeah, I think the how is my world better than the real world question is an interesting one. And it's also interesting to me that he doesn't ask the counter question, how is my world worse than the real world? Because it seems to me that, generally speaking, compelling worlds are both better and worse than the real world in some way. Right? Where in just continuing the Narnia example, in Narnia, the world is better because animals can talk and magic is a thing, and children can be mighty warriors, right?
Sure.
But it's worse because there's a witch that wants to murder you.
Yeah.
And all and half the trees are evil. There's a wolf that wants to... So many things want to murder you, right? Where
it's
in real life,
place.
Almost nothing wants to murder us.
Right.
Because we live in America.
Well, anywhere, really. Like, humans are apex.
We live in a society.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think those two things kind of go hand in hand to produce a compelling world. Where a world that's just everyone here is a superhero isn't actually very interesting because, well, then isn't... Going back to the...
Everyone is super.
Right. That's right. Going back to the Incredibles there. And so you have to have... I'm not sure credible threat is quite the right term, but you have to have a reason for special parts of your world to be special.
Some credible debt on the part of the world that it owes for being better than the real world in some other way.
Right.
Because the question that players are trying to answer by playing your game is generally, how do I be a better me in real life?
I feel like most people are not aware that they are asking that question, if they are at all.
Okay.
I feel like, depending on the game, right? But I feel like most people are trying to answer the question, how do I get to the end of Tomb Raider, when they are playing Tomb Raider?
Sure, but all the threats and all the systems in Tomb Raider are designed around real-world threats and systems. They're certainly not as complex or as difficult as real-world systems, or as dangerous. In many ways, it's much more simple. And that's probably something that he should ask here in the lens of the world as well. How is my world simpler than the real world?
Right.
But they are all things that you could conceivably do in real life. And I feel like that's the core reason for why games are interesting. Like in chess, it's about marshaling and guiding an army, and or maybe even a kingdom. And that's something that you can't do in real life without a great deal of trouble, but you can in the game. And I feel like that's a lot of the reason that it's more interesting than Go, for example, which, well, it's a deeper strategy game and simpler rules. It doesn't have a theme that people can latch onto that motivates them to engage with it.
Sure.
Well, that's it for Chapter 17, One Lens. I think we'll save Chapter 18 for later.
Alrighty.